Hello, I'm Carrie Weber, the Managing Editor of America. This week, we're speaking with Vincent Rougeau, who is the Dean of the Boston College Law School. He's previously served as a professor of law at Notre Dame, as well as the Associate Dean for Academic Affairs there. Rougeau is a graduate of Brown University and of Harvard Law School, where he served as an editor at the Harvard Human Rights Journal. We spoke with Dean Rougeau about his recent article in America's July 7th through 14th issue, about the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act and the enduring legacy of this legislation. Thank you very much, Dean Rougeau, for joining us. I appreciate your taking the time out of your day.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Now, you've written a really compelling and interesting article for our July 7th issue of America Magazine. This summer is the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act, and you write a bit about how, you know, our nation is founded on sort of the freedom of individuals, but also sort of deeply rooted in this systemic denial of those freedoms to many people in our nation. I wonder if you could elaborate on that conflict and that contrast.
Sure. I mean, I think for people who are the descendants of, well, obviously the descendants of slaves, or for lots of people of color or who've fallen outside of the mainstream of American society, it's always been kind of startling to be part of a group that is very much linked to an aspect of American culture and society that focuses primarily on one's group status in a country that prides itself on its individualistic rhetoric. So all Americans, I think, are totally infused with the notion of the primacy of the individual and the possibilities available to individuals and the stories of the United States as a nation that provided so much opportunity to individuals in so many different ways. Yet, during all of that history, there's been, for most of it at least, a very concerted effort to categorize some people in a group and to efface their individuality and to make sure that they remained somewhat invisible because of that and discriminated against as well.
So in what ways did the Civil Rights Act sort of help to transform the way we viewed both individuals and groups of people in our society in the short term and over the long term?
So I guess in the short term, you know, what the Civil Rights Act represents for me is this coming to consciousness for the broad cross-section of Americans of the fact that, you know, in our midst there are these people that are somewhat indistinguishable to us. I mean, they're part of a group that isn't really part of the mainstream, and their individuality wasn't really that important. It wasn't really a part of the story of America, other than as a group, they were either slaves or black people or, you know, Negroes, whatever they were, but they just really weren't important as individuals or really important. Suddenly, after World War II in particular, I think there was this recognition that this is a real contradiction for the United States to present itself as a nation founded on all of these principles around individual freedom and individual respect and dignity, and to have in its midst this group of people that really weren't accorded those freedoms. So bit by bit, the nation started to change. So you had the Brown v. Board of Education decision in 1954, and then by 1964, the Civil Rights Act. So you see this sort of emergence of a new recognition in post-World War II America through these landmark legal cases that some changes needed to happen if the United States was really to be the country it claimed to be.
Right. You've described it as a moment of exceptional self-awareness as a nation. Now, given the divisiveness that takes place in much of American politics today, do you think we still sort of have the capacity to enact this sort of broad change or to really live out what the hopes of this act were?
Well, unfortunately, I think we've entered a period of a real lack of self-awareness. I think we've entered a period where we've become almost ungovernable in a sense. I mean, we're so rooted, so many of us, or at least so many people in our public life, are rooted to these ideologies that make it impossible for them to see the broader common good as an essential part of what they do in public service, serving that broader common good. So service in Congress, for instance, becomes primarily about serving the group that put you, that elected you, and representing to them a certain kind of ideological purity in how you behave as a public servant or in Congress. And that's no way to run a country. I mean, that's not a prescription for problem solving, for leadership. So I worry that our inability to transcend some of our political differences bodes ill for the future.
Right. Well, you wrote about the idea that the Civil Rights Act helped to transform the U.S. into the sort of global superpower in a way, and the idea that we can no longer sort of live out those ideals and that self-awareness. Do you think that implies maybe we're headed away from being a global leader?
I think that's a conclusion you might draw. I mean, and some of it may just be natural. I mean, we can't forever assume that we will always be the preeminent global superpower forever. Certain events put us in that position, you know, in the 20th century, and events or circumstances will change. Say, economic circumstances, the growing global power of other countries will obviously affect how we're viewed. But, you know, I do think some of our loss in status may be a result of our own behavior and not because of the behavior of others or because of economic changes. I mean, our inability to deal with some of our internal problems in a healthy way and to really take on, you know, issues in a way that suggests that we have an understanding of what's best for the nation as a whole and we don't really operate primarily based on, you know, the needs of interest groups is a sign of weakness internally. I mean, it's not a sign that we are positioning ourselves for a long-term global role or a global leadership role. I see us becoming, in many ways, at least in, again, in public life, divided and small-minded and sniping about things that really aren't that important, while really important issues are left to become worse.
So you point out that young adults today don't remember what the country was like prior to 1964. Many people were either not born or were very young. And I think that maybe many people could be better informed. Do you think that having a better sense of our country's history could help transform our country's future?
Absolutely. And I think it's so important that we talk about what happened in the past and we talk about the mistakes that we made as a country. We talk about the things that we just didn't do well, the things we just didn't get. And one of the points I tried to make in the piece is, you know, let's look at slavery. I mean, the United States was really late in eliminating slavery, and the only way it got eliminated in this country was through an excruciatingly violent war. That's something I think that's worth exploring. I mean, why was that? What was it about this country and about this culture and about us as a people that made that so difficult and made the resolution of slavery so violent? And why did, after slavery, did we hang on so, you know, tightly to the system of racial segregation and Jim Crow and the rest for 100 more years? It's not something that we should be proud of, and I don't suggest that anyone is proud of it, but I mean, not talking about it or not being aware of it, not making it an important part of how we understand who we are as a nation is a mistake, because I think by owning that history, recognizing it, talking about it, and learning from it, we will avoid future mistakes of that type, we can hope. But also, we just have a better sense of the reality of who we are. I mean, no one is perfect, no nation is perfect, and, you know, understanding our weaknesses is an important part of sort of growing as an adult community, as becoming a nation that has taken on the mantle of global leadership and recognizes its flaws as well as its strengths.
Right. I think there's a sense of the importance of humility there that I think is sort of crucial in any kind of leadership position, whether as individuals or as a nation.
Absolutely. I mean, and if you look around, there are other countries that have gone through very difficult and violent and tragic periods, and they've tried to address them in various ways. Not every country, but some countries that we know well. I mean, look at South Africa, that has a racial history that has many similarities to our own. You know, they've tried very hard to be open about the challenges that presents through truth and reconciliation commissions and through legal changes. And every country will deal with this in a different way based on the particular history it's facing. But yeah, I think to grow as a leader and to claim a place of leadership in the world requires that humility, requires that recognition of reality in our past.
I think sometimes there's a trend or a tendency for people, in an effort to sort of overcome that past, to pretend that
race doesn't exist, that they don't know who is black or who is white. And as you point out in the article, sometimes that actually gets in the way of dialogue about these issues and of things that really need to be said.
Absolutely. It's something we've got to talk about. And I can understand the impulse of not wanting race to become the primary feature of how we see people. And I hope that we will reach a point in time where it really is not that significant. But given our history and given our current reality, where we know that, you know, people are definitely categorized in that way and many suffer disadvantages because of it, we need to be a little bit more open about the role that race is playing. I mean, look at the situation in Detroit, for instance. Does it not matter that that city for a very, very long time has been predominantly black, and that there has been a longstanding tradition in the state of Michigan, a longstanding tendency politically, culturally, socially, to isolate the city of Detroit from the rest of the state. You know, that so you leave a city poor and heavily minority, and you know, you wonder why, you know, as an industry collapses, the city has no resources at its disposal and goes bankrupt. It's race is a part of that story, and our racial history is a part of that story. So we should own that, talk about it, and ask ourselves, are there things that we ought to do to account for that?
So what kind of conversations around race today do you think are ones that really need to be had, or ones that are being ignored, or are we meant to change the dialogue in a new and different way?
Well, I think both of those things have to happen. I think, as I tried to suggest a little bit in the piece, that we are probably at a transition point in how we understand race in this country and in our culture, but it's a transition point. It doesn't mean the old things have gone away, and it doesn't preclude the new possibilities that may be emerging. We still live with the residue of very intense and very rigid legal, structural, social segregation. I mean, there are still residues of that in our world and in our lives. A lot of it has gone away, but issues still come up around things like affirmative action and discrimination in employment and housing and lending that are based on color and race and ethnicity. I mean, categories that we need to be able to talk about, because people see them and they act based on their perception of what those categories mean. We know that people suffer all kinds of exclusion because of race. We know that public schools in large cities are still heavily racially segregated, and actually not just large cities, increasingly in suburbs as well. And we may not be able to solve every problem related to that, but if we understand that we have to face a reality that urban schools will always be, at least for the foreseeable future, heavily minority, then what does that mean for resource allocation? What does that mean for the way we structure leadership in those schools? And we should talk about that, recognizing the reality of the racial composition of those schools, and maybe not worry so much about how can we make it different? You know, how are we going to make it more integrated? We've spent a lot of time trying to do that. Sometimes it's worked, but it hasn't worked as well as we had hoped. So maybe we have to rethink our approach, but that will require talking about race.
Right. And as you pointed out, the idea of race is not as black and white as people think it is. There's the reality of many multiracial families today, and the nuances of people's heritages and where they're from and what nation people are from and how that shapes their identity.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that that's a really hopeful and positive change. And, you know, when I was speaking earlier about, you know, black people being sort of invisible and a group as opposed to being individuals with, you know, individual stories and an individual dignity, I mean, that's one of the changes you see. I mean, your ethnic background as a black person in the United States 50 years ago made little difference. I mean, nobody with power was really interested in that because it didn't matter. You were just black. But now, I mean, with the growth of immigration and an increasingly multiracial kinds of engagement culturally, people are conscious of those stories and want to express themselves through multiracial heritages and are being recognized as multiracial people. So that's a new conversation that's starting in the United States and that will need to be entertained and discussed. I mean, we need to talk a little bit about what it means and how that reflects our identity as Americans. I mean, who is an American isn't just a story that can be told by looking at someone and categorizing them based on their heritage, say, as European or whatever. I mean, Americans are multiracial and increasingly, you know, multi-ethnic, and there are just lots of stories about Americans that involve multiple heritages. To me, I think that's a great thing. That says that our country can be welcoming to people of all kinds of backgrounds, and those people can claim an American identity and also retain various cultural identities as well.
Another interesting point that I think you've made is that the idea of comprehensive immigration reform and the way that we treat people coming to our nation now is a real extension of the Civil Rights Act.
Yeah, I mean, for me, as a child of the Civil Rights Movement, you know, I was born a few months before in the Civil Rights Act, well, about a year before the Act was passed. And, you know, my parents were very involved in the Civil Rights Movement. And so I sort of lived through its sort of growth and maturity. When I see what's happening around immigration, a lot of what I think I see immigrants dealing with resonates with me in terms of what I think about and what I've experienced through the civil rights era in the United States for Black people. Obviously there's some very different issues involved. I mean, citizens versus non-citizens being a critical one. But at the base of all of it is about, we're talking about human dignity, and we're talking about a recognition of barriers to membership and participation in the life of our democracy, and what kinds of categories matter and what kinds of categories don't. And, you know, I think the more we unpack the immigration issue, the more we start to realize that some of the categories that we think are important really aren't so important, and other things matter more. And so we need to have the kind of conversation around immigration that I think we were having 50 years ago around race and segregation, because we have many, many people living amongst us who are living lives where their dignity is heavily compromised, but where we, many of us, benefit from their presence in the labor market and our cultural lives in so many different ways. So to not be engaged in some kind of effort to give them meaningful membership amongst us, I think is a great shame, and will be something that we will regret if we don't try to work on figuring out a way through this problem. And unfortunately, our leaders are in the Congress and elsewhere seem incapable of dealing with this issue.
Now, you mentioned your parents' involvement in the civil rights movement. Are there any stories that they've told you from their lives that sort of really stick with you, or that you go back to, or that inspire you in some way?
Well, I'm probably very similar to many other African Americans of my generation. So many of us have so many stories that kind of are part of the fabrics of our families. One I often tell is, I was the first Black baby born in the Catholic hospital in Miami Beach, which was segregated, even though this was 1963. It wasn't officially segregated. Everyone just knew that Black children weren't delivered at that hospital. And my mother actually worked as a dietitian at the Jewish hospital in Miami, Mount Sinai, where she was invited to have me. But she said, no, I should be able to have my son at a Catholic hospital. We're Catholic. And so, you know, she went over and discussed it with her doctor, and the nuns were wonderful. They said, of course you should have your baby here. You know, it caused a bit of a stir at the hospital, particularly with her roommate, who, you know, initially was not too pleased to see her. But as I think often happens when people are sharing a very important experience in their lives, they became friendly by the end of it. But the funniest thing about the delivery was that, since the hospital had never really delivered African-American babies, they didn't know that we don't all come out looking the same. So we have different skin tones. And so I came out looking to the nurses like a white baby. And when my mother asked to see her baby, they said, well, there are no Negro babies in the hospital. We don't know where your baby is.
Oh my gosh, she must have been terrified.
She was pretty upset. Oh, fortunately, she said, I was somewhat sedated. But they did have to call the doctor in to calm her down, and he found me with my little bracelet on that said who I was from the beginning, but they just couldn't believe that I was actually African American. So, you know, that was just the typical day. You know, lots of stories like that are infused my family, and I'm sure the families of many other people I know. But, you know, and we laugh about it now, but I think about the trauma my mother had to endure just to make a very simple point that as a Catholic woman in Miami, why should she hesitate to, you know, have her baby at a Catholic hospital in 1963? I'm always inspired by my parents and the many, many things they had to do to make that point over and over and over again in different settings. So, you know, I tell a couple of the stories in the pieces, in the piece about different relatives and about some of my wife's family, but I stop myself from time to time and remember, you know, as I go through the same stages of my life that they were going through at that time, how much more effort and how much more of a burden that put on them as they were just going through the normal stresses and strains of marrying, having children, getting jobs, getting houses, keeping jobs, you know, going through the trials and tribulations of life with this overlay of sort of pushing into an environment that was somewhat hesitant to welcome them. So, or very hesitant in some cases to welcome them. So, you know, this is a good opportunity for me to give thanks and to send my signal of love and respect to my parents, my in-laws, and my grandparents, and all the people who really called this nation to account and said, we must do better. And they really sacrificed. They paid a price that most people don't pay to make that point.
You talk about your family's Catholic faith. I wonder how that has shaped you and shaped your family's sense of identity over the years as well.
Yeah, it's a very important part of who we are and who I am. And, you know, it was also when I was talking about identity and how for Black people often identity was not, you know, the complications of identity were not really recognized back then. You know, being an African-American Catholic was sort of an oddity. But my parents are from Louisiana, and there it wasn't. It's a deep part of the history, and it's part of a multicultural history. But throughout my life, not so much in recent years, but you know, earlier in my life, you know, I had to explain not just to white people, but to Black people too. You know, why it was not weird for me to be Catholic and to have a French name, and in the United States at least, that was strange. But I think it taught me a lot that has informed my views today. I mean, it taught me about the fact that, you know, who we are as people is usually a very complex story. And for me, you know, being Catholic is a very important part of that story. It really has shaped so many of my values and the way I approach all kinds of issues in my life, in my work, in the law. And, you know, it's inspired me in many ways. You know, my grandparents' deep faith has always been an inspiration to me. I mean, these are people who lived most of their lives in segregation, but never once wavered from, you know, their commitment to their faith and to the church and to what it represented and to the values that they drew from it. They knew the world was flawed, and they knew that lots of things about the lives that we lead are problematic, but they took great strength from their faith, and they taught us many, many things about people and about forgiveness and about grace that I carry with me every day.
I'd imagine so. Well, thank you so much. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us and for sharing your stories.
Well, thanks for chatting with me. It was a real pleasure.